Jazz hands. Right. Ooh. Ooh, yeah. Season 4, my favorite game. Begin in 3, 2, 1. Chris Avalon, what is your favorite game?
My favorite game is Wasteland. You know, I first got into playing games. Most of my experience was pen and paper games. But then, way back in the old days, my dad brought home a very unusual device. It was called TRS-80, a personal home computer. And it had 4K worth of memory, which was amazing. You could ask it to do all sorts of basic programming and coding. And it was a very primitive machine by today's standards, but it did come with games. It had this really horrible adventure game called Haunted House, which was sort of like a basic text parser adventure game, and it basically cheated. It was a horrible game. I'm still convinced this day that the second level of that game was basically, there's no way you could have figured it out. And it was so primitive, in fact, that all the games came on little tape cassettes, and the computer would actually read the data off of the tape cassette. So you got to listen to it playing while it was loading the information in the computer. It was quite an experience. And so, anyway, from there, I went on to bigger and larger computers. But the real revelation came when I saw a Commodore 64 at my friend's house. And I saw a game called Bard's Tale being played on it. I'm like, oh my God, like you can, this game already has a preset D&D dungeon in it. You can build your own party and go on explorations and adventures. So, you know, I immediately went home and told my dad that for the sake of education, it'd probably be good if the household got a Commodore 64 because we learned so many things from it. You know, it'd be really, really, really good for our education. And he agreed. And then, from there, I played numerous games coming out at the time. There was the Gold Box series was coming. Gold Box probably actually came a number of years after that. But the point was, after I exhausted Bard's Tale, which I had to cheat at, especially Bard's Tale 2, because that game was pretty damn hard. But after I did all the Bard's Tale run, I started getting restless because it didn't seem like there were any other RPGs out there to play. So I'd keep going back to the electronics boutique store, which was kind of like the GameStop of the day. And I keep scouring the shelves for any sort of new RPG that would come out. And I saw this game called Wasteland, and I wasn't like super excited about it, but I checked the back of the back box cover, and it looked enough like Bard's Tale where I'm like, well, if I don't really have anything else to play, why don't I try this game? So, and Wasteland was basically, at first glance, appeared to be just a post-apocalyptic Mad Max Bard's Tale. You could make your own party of rangers and go exploring the wasteland, but it was so different in so many respects that it just still stands out to this day.
Is there anything further in that kind of caught your eye before you jumped into the industry side of things then? Like, among the lines of Bard's Tale and Westland?
There were a few other games before, like actually, you know, hit the industry side of things. Gaming slowed down in the later stages of high school and college, just because life was getting so busy on the pen and paper game side, because it was actually making contacts there, getting in touch with publishers, and then trying to figure out how to get more like written works published. So gaming took a little bit of a backseat around those times, just because I suddenly found quote-unquote more productive things to do with my time. It seemed to actually advance fun and advance a career at the same time.
In that instance, then, we'll jump into how you first got into the industry side of things then.
Yeah, so I used to have to be a pen and paper game master, because my players were sort of always too lazy to want to run a game. So what I would do is, in order to be able to pretend that I could be a player in the game, I would actually have to run the entire session, write all the adventures and the modules, and it ran from things like D&D, Temple of Elemental Evil, to Champion superhero games. And superhero games ended up being important because of all the adventures that I wrote. Like, I would store those and keep all the maps drawn and make all the, you know, computer printouts. And once I saw this stack of stuff that I'd created, it felt like a huge waste not to do anything with it, or at least try and do anything with it. So I would package them up for submissions to game companies. Like, hey, you should really check out this module I wrote. It's really cool. And they'd be like, we respond back and go, no, actually, it's not very cool, and then we're going to reject it. So that went through a whole bunch of no's and no thank yous, and we get a lot of submissions, and unfortunately, yours doesn't meet our requirements this time. But then Champions were starting a brand new line of a superhero campaign called Dark Champions, which is kind of like their version of Batman, which Champions really didn't have at that time. It's basically like low-level heroes and champions trying to take the war to the mean streets. So it's, you know, it's kind of sort of like Netflix Daredevil, and, well, sort of like Jessica Jones, but even though Jessica Jones can fly and she can do crazy stuff. Anyway, so they're like, well, you've been sending us a lot of annoying submissions, and we have an opening for this new campaign, and we need content for it, which basically means they were desperate. And then they were like, and obviously you can write copious amounts and keep annoying us with submissions, so we're going to let you write one character book for this product line. I'm like, oh, wow, that's great. Thanks, guys. Well, I feel really honored. I should have taken a step back and go, you know what? They just need someone to write. But the important thing is, like, the persistence paid off, and they knew who I was, so it was a good fit at that time. So I sort of got a battlefield promotion. From not being a writer to actually getting a chance. So I submitted this character book. It went pretty well. People really liked it. My editor really liked it. And that became important because later on, when I, you know, 6 months into the pen and paper game industry, I suddenly realized why there were openings in the pen and paper game industry. And that's because it doesn't pay very well, if it pays. Which was also a delightful aspect. I had this naive notion that when you produce something, you get paid for it. And in the pen and paper game industry, they're usually so strapped for cash, that's a rare thing. So after, like, you know, a book or two and a few modules, I suddenly realized I couldn't make a living at it. So I went to my editor, and I'm like, hey, I'd really love to keep writing for you guys, but I need to get a real job. And while I would prefer not to be a teacher or a banker or a lawyer, can you recommend anything that you think I could apply for that I may not know about? And my editor says, well, you're in luck, because Interplay Entertainment out in California just opened their D&D division, and they are looking for designers to sort of flesh out content for their games. And he's like, if you want, I could put in a recommendation to the head of that studio, and see if he can set up an interview and then go from there. And I'm like, oh, that'd be great. And then I found out later that part of his reward for doing that with any applicant was he would get $300 worth of free software. So I felt a bit like a prostitute, but I even got to see them trade the bag of software. It was pretty dirty. So I So I flew out there. I got lost on the way to the interview. I was overdressed with a suit and a tie, or maybe it was just a suit. Actually, it was just a suit. I think the CEO, Marco Green at the time, was like, "You're lucky you didn't walk in here with a tie, because if you'd walked in here with a tie, we would have grabbed some scissors and cut it off." And I'm like, "Okay." And he took me around the studio. I saw everyone having just a really good time. Everyone was like really crunched together in the building, but like everyone was dressed really casually. You know, there were the free sodas everywhere. You know, like, the games were being played. I'm like, "Oh my God, this place is amazing." And he's like, "Well, you know, Chris, we got this new Planescape license. You know, we spent a lot of money on doing all these D&D licenses, like Forgotten Realms and Planescape. And so if you were to pitch us a Planescape game, what would it be like?" So I pitched him my idea for a Planescape game, and he liked it. And he seemed to like me, or at least endure me. So he's like, "Well, we could offer you a job as a junior designer." And I'm like, "Oh, that sounds great. Wow, steady paycheck." And so I drove cross country from Virginia all the way to California, and I started my career at Interplay and spent about 10 years there. And before Interplay kind of fell on hard times, then I moved over to Obsidian for about 10 years, and now I am flying free and my wings are spread. I'm very happy.
How are you finding freelance life? Because speaking as a fellow freelancer, it's fucking difficult.
I wasn't sure if freelancing was going to work out. I do know that I wasn't happy any longer on just focusing on one thing day after day, especially if that was troublesome and I had no control over what was going on. Like, I don't think I realized how much maybe having smaller projects with very tight goals and then having a selection of those to choose from, or just being able to pursue almost anything. Like, I think that the level of freedom that I have as a contractor is really interesting. Like, so for example, if there's someone that I've always admired or wanted to work with back at Interplay or Obsidian, like, you really can't consider that. Like, you're doing what the company's doing. Like, there will be franchises cut off to you. There will be certain other companies cut off to you. But now I can call anybody, or they can call me, and we can figure something out. Like, I'm like, "Oh, well, I always wanted to work with you." And they're like, "Oh, we've always wanted to work with you." And you can just, you know, get the ball rolling. And that's been crazy. I guess I didn't realize exactly how much range of opportunities there were out there. And the other nice thing, too, is when you're at certain companies doing certain genres and technologies of games, now there's no limitation. So, like, for example, like, you know, I used to bitch a lot and unfairly about, "Oh, well, you know, I don't really like, you know, doing continually menu-driven dialogue systems. There's got to be, you know, something better out there that helps communicate a narrative." And so, for example, now I've discovered, like, I've been able to do narrative work in the VR space, for example, and the whole narrative aspects of VR is so hugely different in a great way. Like, the way dialogue mechanics work and the immediacy of the people around you and the fact that your very gestures can be used to communicate, like, you know, whether you accept someone's handshake or something as simple as, like, you know, nodding your head or shaking it no to communicate to somebody, as well as stuff in the environment that you can use. It's just crazy. And I don't think I would have had that perspective or possibility had I remained at either studio. And so it's nice to learn new things.
Hmm. Well, it's just, when you did leave Obsidian, it's just like, I think most people, I consider myself here as included as well, like, we all kind of considered you as a kind of for-lifer at Obsidian, which may be a bit of a wrong way to look at it, but nonetheless.
I'd spent almost about 15 or 16 years working with a chunk of the same people. Like, a lot of the people that left Black Isle to go to Obsidian were people that I'd sort of gone through the trenches with, at Black Isle and again at Obsidian. And I'm still friends with a number of those developers today. For example, Brian Menzi, the concept artist who, you know, worked on Fallout and did the Vault Boy, for example. Me and him still talk quite frequently, and you know, in fact, we just be at lunch the other day. And I love those guys. I think, however, it's really rough being married for 15 years to four other husbands. that's a lot of responsibility, and that's also part of the. It's kind of your perspectives narrow when you're continually in that same environment, and also, I think they as much as you might make assumptions about them, they certainly start to making assumptions about you in terms of, Chris could never do interface design, or Chris could never explore systems. What Chris does is we want Chris to write. And if Chris starts talking, then Chris probably should just write some more. And I'm like, eventually, I just kind of get tired of it. And I just wanted to do new things.
No, fair enough. I mean, now that you have kind of sprung your wings and flown from the nest, so to speak, how have you found that? I've basically more or less asked the question already, but I'll ask in terms of, because you're working with In Exile now on Torment, and you're also working now with Divinity 2, how are you finding those kind of new projects, breathing into life into those projects?
Yeah, so there's actually a range of stuff I'm working on. Those two products are the ones that I can talk about. The first one, the Torment successor, Torment Tides of Numenera, that was something that I was contracted for through Obsidian, And using part of Obsidian's technology for that RPG. So a lot of the work there has been to finish off the first pass of writing for that game. Just to make sure that credit is given where credit is due, my amount of writing on Tides of Numenera was always focused on doing storyline reviews and doing one of the companions for the game. A lot of the writing was done by Adam Heine, who's the project design lead and project lead, Colin McComb, who I worked with on the first Planescape Torment, and also a very fine writer, Gavin, whose last name I'm not going to try and pronounce because I always just call him Gavin. I don't think I've ever actually heard his last name in conversation, but he is a writing powerhouse. And if we access Twitter after this, I'm going to make sure I shout his name 100 million times. But those guys are doing the sort of brunt work when it comes to the amount of dialogue in the game. And also for Divinity Original Sin 2, that was kind of an unusual meetup. And I guess that's one thing that I'd say about Freedom is, so when Sven, who runs Larian Studios, was doing the Kickstarter for Original Sin 2, he did something kind of unusual where he actually had people suggest stretch goals to him, which was kind of cool. I'm like, okay, that's an interesting way to approach it. But then there's a website called RPG Codex that sort of put their backs into promoting, hey, one of your stretch goals or one of your funding targets should be, you should try and get Chris Avalon to write for you and contribute to the story. And that generated a lot of upvotes on the forum. And then Sven actually contacted me at, I think it was PAX East. It was PAX Prime. And we sat down. We had a conversation about whether, we saw eye to eye on role-playing games. He showed me the demo for Original Sin 2, and I really liked it. I was a little bit skeptical about the game at first, not from the art side. It looked beautiful, and I liked a lot of the dungeon mechanics they had set up. But what kind of made me a little bit wary at first was I didn't understand how some of the player character inner party conflicts were going to work, because the first thing you sort of learn as a game master is generally there's always danger in backstabbing party mechanics or having differing agendas, because that can tear a party apart pretty quickly, because players are the most dangerous force in the universe, especially when they're turned against each other. But then I saw a demo of how he was doing it, And then I'm like, oh, okay, I see how this works now. So I'm that. So then immediately I'm like, oh, I'm going to learn something from this project, if not many things. And ever since I've been involved with the storyline creation, and they have a whole team of writers at Larian, Charlene Putney, Devin Doyle, and Jan, I can't pronounce his last name. I'm going to try. It's like Von Dossler. He's probably going to kill me when he hears this. And so what we do is actually we hop onto Google and Skype, and then what we do is we run through the story with Sven and iterate on it and discuss each paragraph, and is it you know, creating the right amount of drama and tension, is it a good plot point, and having those that amount of writers all sort of bouncing a story around and sort of feeding off of each other has been really cool. I've really been enjoying that experience.
Now that you have this newfound freedom, like, is there any dream projects that you think you'd love to do now that you are this lone wolf?
Yes, there are definitely dream projects. The part of that dream project procedure is, so I had to get reacquainted with the pitch process first off. In terms of, okay, well, who are the people at studios you talk to nowadays? Like, how do you set up a presentation pitch? Is there some way you can fund something yourself? Like, that, you know, that isn't necessarily Kickstarter. Like, you know, can I, you know, up the bank account until, like, I could just, you know, do it myself without having to bother the community? So there's stuff like that. And that's been really interesting because from the pitch process itself, I don't know whether, like, it just wasn't clicking back at previous companies, but the pitches I've all been involved with actually just, they seem to go really well. And then, like, the project starts rolling a lot faster. So the success rate for those has upped considerably. So that's been kind of a surprising twist. And also, that also creates a good steady stream of work right there. The other thing is I've also gone in search of developers that are playing with technologies or franchises or themes that I want to get my sort of hands dirty with again, like whether it's, you know, science fiction, whether it's a certain franchise I've always wanted to write for, or in some cases, there's just a developer that I think I could learn a lot from or would just enjoy working with, and I will reach out to them and vice versa, and then we would start collaborating on something that we think will be a cool design element, either as an entire game or as part of a game.
When you put it like that, are you talking with, like, companies on various levels, whether it be an indie doing a Kickstarter or even AAA developers and publishers?
It runs that entire range. So the way I approach it is, there are some projects that I reach out to where I actually just do it for free because I want to work with that developer, and I recognize that they probably don't have a ton of, you know, cash to throw around, but it's something that I would like to dig into, and I like them, and so therefore being paid isn't as important to me as learning from that experience and working with those developers. And I usually find that those contacts and that experience pays off in many other ways in the long run that have nothing to do with finances. And I think, and that's important to me. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there have been AAA game opportunities, which I have taken, where they will isolate a certain section of that game and they will either ask me to, like, hey, you know, flesh this out, tackle this. And I enjoy doing that usually because it's either in a genre that I'm not as I didn't have the same opportunities to explore, or it's a much more RPG experience than I'm used to, but the framework and the franchise sort of makes it feel new again. So there's a whole range of stuff from AAA to indie to just doing free work that I think is fun, and having that level of freedom. I've been able to hit sort of all those bases.
Bye.
let's get into it then. Your favorite game, Wasteland. So we talked about a bit there earlier about what about the RPGs you were playing when you were starting out gaming, and Wasteland came at around a golden period for the RPG era. Like how was that like at the time? It was very much a golden age of, you know, computer RPGs, certainly at that time.
Yeah, there were three companies that were really standing out at the time, or at least in my ancient memory. One was Origin was doing all the great Ultima series, which was fantastic. Then there was the SSI was poised to sort of hit the D&D stride with all their gold box games. And then around the Origin times, there was also Interplay was always a big RPG contender, and they always seemed to be turning out very cool RPGs. And the fact that I would one day work with those guys was almost inconceivable to me. There would have been Bard's Tale, like 1, 2. That series seemed to be going strong, and then Wasteland came out around that time. And again, like I was a little skeptical of it. But then once I started playing it, it really opened my eyes to what an RPG could be, much like Fallout 1 did when Fallout came out, many, many, many years later.
Like, we mentioned how you first got on the Wasteland, so I won't go into that question. But, for those who've yet to play Wasteland, and it's readily available on Good Old Games, I think, and Steam, and... Yep. Give the elevator pitch for Wasteland.
So Wasteland tells the story of this organization called the Desert Rangers that were built from a core of army engineers that got isolated in the desert of the southwest United States when all these nuclear warheads started falling all over the place. It was very much, in terms of ambience, kind of like what would it happen if the world froze in the 1980s or the sort of what was quote unquote the future at that time, because, you know, it was just, we were just stepping into the 80s at this point, and Wasteland was kind of like living under that shadow of nuclear fear in the world. And then it advanced the future a few more years past its release. But ultimately players woke up from this nuclear holocaust. They survived by sort of taking control of this prison in the southwest. And then as the game starts, the threat is pretty vague. Like, generally, the way they describe it is the Desert Rangers, like, are sort of devoted to keeping peace in the area. But you don't really know what the area is like, because you're like the new recruits. So, you build up your characters, and you go out in search of this vague threat to the southwest. And the thing that threw me the first point, though, was at character creation, you started getting options I hadn't seen before at that time. And then among the first of those was I suddenly noticed the game had skills. Like, hey, you know, you can, you know, you get, you, for example, like, here's pugilism, for example. You can just punch people better. Or like, here's toaster repair. And all sorts of skills that I discovered that when I was making each character, like, okay, well, this is going to be the pistol pack gun person, or this is going to be the knife thrower. I suddenly noticed that when I could assign points to very specific skills like that, I was getting a much clearer picture of what type of character I was making. And that started getting really exciting from a role-playing, opportunity. Also, it did have the unfortunate RPG mechanic where a lot of the games at that time, when you were sort of like creating your character, you'd be sort of rolling up your character. So unfortunately, what usually happened in that case was you'd sit in front of the computer for an hour, hitting the space bar, hoping that you could luck out and, with gambling and get like a whole set of amazing stats. And then you would save that as your character. And then they gave you some basic ranger equipment. And then they sent you out into a very, very primitive looking, from an art standpoint, wasteland. And you started to explore the small communities around the area, eventually discovering a larger and larger threat to the entire Southwest and the world. And the whole run of it was pretty amazing.
I just want to mention as well, like, for me and you, like, we have a bit of a clash of styles to an extent, because with you, it's when you came in playing games and when you first started out playing, like, these kind of RPGs like Wasteland, Bard's Tale. With me, obviously I'm a bit more modern, with being a 90s kid, PlayStation generation, all out there. Whereas now I play something like Elder Scrolls, Mass Effect, and even maybe this is where both of our styles could kind of clash here. Fallout, at least for you, maybe early Fallout. For me, it'd be something like Bethesda's Fallout here. How do you see those kind of styles in RPGs today?
One thing that I worry about is, so I played Fallout 3 and a very small amount of Fallout 4, and obviously, like, I also worked on Fallout New Vegas. Two things that sort of concern me from a role-playing perspective is I've always been against the idea of players choosing a class, like, oh, Johnny, you know, you with this game, you can either be a fighter, or a rogue, or a mage. I worry that sometimes developers include classes like that to make the systems more comfortable, so it's easier to get your head around and get you into the experience. And that's not a bad choice, but I think in the long term, that prevents you from sort of role playing the character that you could imagine or you want to be. And what I always liked about Fallout was, even though there were suggested archetypes, like, you know, combat guy, you know, speech guy, you know, stealth guy, the way they set up the skill system is you could do any hybrid of those things and be someone very unique. And that was one of the appeals of Fallout. It let you sort of explore the idea that, like, you're the best doctor in the wasteland, but also when push comes to shove, like, you're also the best with a scalpel against any enemies you fight. Like, you could sort of, like, customize your character that way, which was kind of cool. The other thing was, I've sort of always been divided on the concept of voice acting the player character. Not only have I seen that from the developer side just be such a huge budget resource, at the same time, I also worry that also puts some distance between you and role-playing your character, because you're not really saying things with how you imagine your voice sounds. The game's providing that for you. And I'll say that, like, so first off, like, I'm not poo-pooing the voice acting in Mass Effect or Fallout 4. Like, a Fallout 4 especially, the female protagonist voice, Courtney Taylor, she's got an amazing voice. And when playing that character, I get into it. But when I step away from it, I'm like, well, but that's that. I don't know if I would have that same experience if I was imagining my character saying those lines versus hearing Courtney's very beautiful voice recite those lines herself. Those are two things that I think about a lot. The idea of the silent protagonist and the amount of character customization. I don't think players would be put off by those things as much as publishers may worry about.
When you put it like that, it's like publishers, or maybe not publishers, more developers just kind of pigeonhole you into choosing a class that it's set up for you, and it's not for the player to decide what they want to be. It's more, all right, we'll let you choose what you want to be, but you have to do it within the confines of this class.
Yeah, I think I'm just guessing here, but I would imagine it's a combination of developer comfort and bias for the class aspects versus the publisher requirements in that respect. And I don't know if publishers necessarily always agree with that granularity of design decision, strangely enough. However, when it comes to things like voice acting, I think publishers can get very involved, because that's sort of the outward-facing presentation of the game, and it's something that people immediately latch on to. I think So this goes back to all the way back to Knights of the Old Republic 1. But the moment that BioWare decided that they were going to voice act that entire game, that changed the industry, for especially for role-playing games. Suddenly, not only did prices skyrocket, but then that set a level of expectation from then on that the amount of voice acting in the games was going to be sort of like the standard. And so that's sort of been the case that I think everyone has struggled with up until that point. Even arguably, I think BioWare may have struggled with it, because I can't even imagine how large your cinematics department is now and how much resources they have to spend to make, like, for example, the Mass Effect cinematics and cutscenes. That must take a considerable amount of time. Like, they're very, very cool, but I do know that when we're working on Alpha Protocol at Obsidian, that was our first attempt to do a game even remotely like that. And for us, like, we had it was a long learning experience. Like, I really enjoyed it, but it really opened my eyes to, like, how much BioWare's done with a pipeline in an amazing way. Like, Mass Effect 2, like, for example, came out around the same time, and that blew me away. I'm like, wow, they've really got their shit down. It's pretty amazing. So yeah, I think the influences for that class system versus skills, for example, and also that sort of push for voice acting, it can come from different directions, but I'm not convinced those things actually help the role-playing game experience.
Like, what games recently do you think have done class and skills fairly well, at least in terms of RPGs, anyways?
I feel poorly positioned to answer that because, like, for the past year and a half, I've mostly just been playing builds of games I'm working on to make sure that there's no bugs, or I've been testing out games or previous games in a franchise for research purposes. I'll be honest and say there's not one currently that jumps to mind. My exposure to the more recent RPGs, I feel somewhat bad about. I think it's just because I'm creating all the time.
Well, what if I put it forward from the start of the decade, and, like, what game this past decade has done very well? Like you mentioned Mass Effect 2.
Mass Effect 2, what I really liked was I liked a lot of the companion arcs. Okay, that's something I could go into. Like, the companion arcs in games are very tricky to do, because companions are sort of like I feel like almost they're the marketing folk within the game for you. And what they're supposed to do is, like, you know, be sounding boards for your character, you know, themes. They're supposed to provide immediate reactivity and interjections to things you do. And the level of complexity for those companions can be quite extensive. Like, whenever there's a companion on the developer tasking schedule, you know, that's almost a month to, you know, a month and a half of work at least, not counting all the voice acting and reactions to that. So that's been somewhat of a challenge. And I think Mass Effect 2 did that very well. Also, I think looking for ways to blend in sort of the voice acting and characterization of those companions and people around you, because those speeches and lines can get kind of lengthy. You have to really choose your battles in terms of where you want to see or where the player can experience those elements without slowing down the action. And I think Dragon Age Inquisition did a great job of this when you're choosing the world map missions on there, because you can hear your buddies talking in the background during an experience where the player is likely to be doing a lot of thinking and planning. But you can still hear the world going on in the background as you're making those choices. And that's one of the best spots to throw in characterization. And I really applaud them for that. The first time I saw that going on, I was like, very, very well done. And those are a few things that jump out. I also started playing games in a number of other genres, because I was worried that I've been so focused on RPGs that I wasn't looking for solutions that had happened in other games. So I started playing, like, a lot of Telltale games, starting with Walking Dead. And also I'd kind of been missing the whole System Shock experience. So I started doing the BioShock games all the way up to Infinite. And then There was something else that was on my plate that I loved, and I can't remember it. So I must have loved it so much I forgot about it.
You mentioned the episodic games there, like Telltale. I have to ask, because that's a bit of a selfish question, because I love this game so much. What about Life is Strange? Well, that's a bit more of a recent game, so maybe not.
Oh, Life is Strange, I haven't played yet. That and Her Story are two ones that are in my library that I desperately want to play. But then Darkest Dungeon came out, and then that's also in the top three. So then I get sad, because I'm like, when am I going to find time to play all these?
Oh, well, definitely do play Life is Strange.
Oh, crap. Yes, I've heard nothing but good things about it. I'm sorry. Actually, I remember the game that I'd forgotten. One, it was the Amnesia series.
Ah.
Yes, and that one, because I'd been missing a horror game for a while, and the horror mechanics in Amnesia I thought were amazing. And, like, obviously you can't do combat, which immediately terrorizes you, because then you're like, oh, I can't fight back. But the ways that they scared me in that game were amazing. Like, and a lot of it was systems driven. Like that whole concept of, you know, you can't look at the thing stalking you, because if you look at it, you're going to go insane and do damage and kill yourself. So whenever a creature shows up, the first thing you do, aside from hiding, is you turn your character to face away from it. So you're sitting there crouched and huddling in a room in Amnesia, hearing this horrible thing moving around behind you and praying it doesn't spot you, but systematically you can't look at it. And I'm like, oh my God, that is such a great mechanic. Like, and it works so well. What also worked well, which was really simple, was they had chase sequences where these things would just come right after you. But the way the doors worked in that game was, when you got to a door, you actually had to sort of like activate it, but to open it, you had to move backwards. So like you were pulling the door open. During a chase sequence with doors, the last thing you want to do when something is chasing you is move back towards it. And that terrified the shit out of me. It was such a simple mechanic. And they had a bunch of that stuff throughout the game. And it just made me wonder, well, like I always wondered, to like how much other genres have done systems like that that could make RPGs better. And a lot of that had nothing to do with, you know, the text or the prose, or here's a 15-page book about the history of the empire. Like, all that stuff just became like kind of like bullshit versus, well, what's the player actually doing in the game that's sort of communicating the ambience and helping with the background that doesn't require a bunch of like word vomit in your face?
Like, I was having a conversation with Dan Pinchback of the Chinese Room, who made A Machine for Pegs, the sequel, and to paraphrase what he said, it's basically Machine for Pegs, when the Chinese Room made it, it was about confronting your fear no matter what. Like, you know you're just going to be scared anyway, so just push forward. It was basically the concept of pushing forward, essentially.
Yeah, and What I loved about Machine for Pigs was they would take an environment and right at the cusp of making you feel comfortable in that environment, they would show you the environment from a new perspective. And the best example would be like this isn't spoilers, but in the very first opening rooms you encounter, you're like, okay, well, I'm getting a sense for where I am. It's kind of creepy, but I think I can handle it. And almost right when you're starting to have that feeling, then you discover that there's corridors behind the walls in this mansion. And when you start walking through those, suddenly you're able to see into the rooms that you were just traveling through. And then you suddenly realize someone could have been watching you this entire time. And the way those corridors are laid out with props and, you know, like obviously someone's been living there, immediately, like, it adds a new level of terror, because then suddenly you're not sure who's been watching you from what direction. And suddenly even spaces you think you can become comfortable with you no longer can be, because you have no idea what's going to happen next in terms of the environment layout. So that was one thing I certainly loved. And that doesn't even take into account the sound effects or the telephone ringing or crazy shit like that, where you're like, okay, I think I'm getting settled, and suddenly there'd be a new sensory shock from some direction. They did a really good job with that.
So jumping back into Wasteland then, it's had a huge influence, or at least it had a huge influence in the form of pen and paper RPGs. Obviously, two of the devs on the original team, like Ken St. Andre and Michael Stagpole, like, they designed their own tabletop games respectively, as well as working on Wasteland. Like, how big was that influence for the game?
For those two guys, so I've only met Michael Stagpole probably two or three times, but I discovered that whenever he was involved on a computer RPG, like, for example, Bard's Tale 3, suddenly the game took on a new depth that I think only someone who's been working with RPGs for a very long time could put that spin on things. And in Wasteland's case, what really impressed me was, first off, from a system standpoint, they did something very simple at the time, which had enormous complexity if you used it properly. One was, you could take any skill in your inventory, any item in your inventory, any attribute in your inventory, and use it on an object. And that sounds incredibly simple, but suddenly you have 150 ways to use things on your character to cause changes in the environment. And so, for example, like a simple example would be, hey, I'm going to use my climbing rope on this ledge here, and suddenly there's a rope across the chasm that now you can use. Or you use strength to bash down a door. Or, you use your lockpicking skill on a door. That stuff's pretty standard. But then, in the last half of Fallout, I'm sorry, not Fallout. Wow, there's a reason I slipped up on that. But in the last half of Wasteland, they had this amazing sequence in level design, which they laid out a level that was just like the other levels in the game for you to explore, but it actually all took place inside an android's brain. And what happened was, because they had this very simple system set up, you could actually use your intelligence attribute to attack various things in the environment, solve puzzles, and suddenly, just because they changed the context of the level but kept the systems intact, you actually were able to go through this sort of illusionary experience, but you used all your mental attributes to fight your way through. And that was just amazing. I walked away from that going, wow, I don't think I've been thinking properly about level design for a long time. And that, and that was just one thing in that game. Like, they had all sorts of amazing stuff, like being able to clone your own player characters and keep all their original stats. So, like, if you wanted to clone Romanoff, like the heavy weapons expert in your party, you could make five of them. And suddenly you had an entire group of Romanoffs that would be running around blowing people up with bazookas. And they just did so much imaginative stuff in that game that I just hadn't even considered an RPG being possible of carrying out that stuff until I played Wasteland. It was a real eye opener.
Just basically a whole group of tank party characters, essentially.
Yeah, and also I had this really embarrassing technique where I was such a huge introvert. I would sort of imagine these characters as they were, but even when clones got made of them, I started imagining, well, what would it be like if you traveled with your duplicate in the party, and he didn't have the same level of memories that you did, but he had the same capabilities? Like, how would he view you? Like, would he view you as like the obsolete version? But it sparked my imagination, and it got me thinking about stuff like that. So I appreciate Wasteland for that.
What about the amount of freedom Wasteland gifts? How did you find that when you were playing that, like, that kind of freedom it gives you?
It definitely had certain story choke points, obviously, but it did allow you to go almost anywhere, provided you had like a radiation suit. And I did appreciate that. Like, I felt like the world wasn't trying to hem me in. If I wanted to go somewhere, even if it was really dangerous, the game would just let me. And then I would probably suffer for it. But they were letting me sort of, like, explore the world on my own. And I appreciated that versus the linear perspective of, like, go to A, go to B, go to C. Because I'm in a game to have fun. I want to play in the sandbox. And the more you can make a sandbox with interesting things in it, that's more appealing to me. Like, I like that freedom of experience. And I think that also helps the role-playing experience.
Like, you mentioned how you were looking to clone, like, the tanks within your party. Like, what was the kind of player, what was the kind of character that you want, or let me rephrase the question. Like, what was the kind of play style that you wanted your character to be in Wasteland? Like, you mentioned, like, you had your, like, you were cloning your tanks, their tank characters, like, but, like, in terms of your own character, like, what was your aim to be within the game with your play style?
So the sort of play style that I was going for was, and it would also change over time once I discovered new skills and new areas in the game, because that would put my motivations in context. I sort of saw by my play experience as I don't always try and min-max the characters. I actually just try and make characters that I sort of can imagine working together as a party. So, for example, like, I might have the intelligence expert, and that particular guy may not be the fastest guy, but for some reason he might be an excellent knife thrower, for example. That's his one shtick, but the rest of his time is spent on computer programming and hacking, or if you discover, like, cloning technology, he's the one that's going to be able to wrap his head around that. And Wasteland had a really cool mechanic where they wouldn't tell you what all the skills were at first. They would slowly unlock skills over time, the smarter you got. So there was also a mechanic there where you may not know a certain skill exists until you advance your attributes to a certain level or find a certain library, and then suddenly a new skill reveals itself. And so the game allowed sort of my characters to grow over time. So I'm like, okay, well, now I have the computer expert, but now he's exploring cloning technology. And then when that skill becomes available in the game, I start imagining how the character would sort of react to that. So first off, he's presented with this world where, you know, probably primitive, tabletop computers are his only option. But now he's discovered a way of sort of creating life. Like, as a character, like, do I imagine how I could use my computer programming to actually start programming a certain kind of human? And, like, that's the kind of questions that the game would raise in my mind just with those combinations of skills and those discoveries and the fact that it's only available to that character. For example, like, I always try to imagine, like, for that first leader slot, like, what makes a leader for a party of rangers like that? And, you know, it may not be like she's the most charismatic person, but she's just got the right, you know, kind of luck, determination, or she's really tricky with her tactics or how she uses demolitions. So maybe she's not the toughest, baddest person in the Wasteland, but the reason she's the leader is because she's always thinking three steps ahead. So when a combat breaks out, she's just so well prepared for it that she can beat a superior opponent. And for me, I'm like, okay, well, that could be a really cool, like, leader attribute. And that's because of how she uses her skills tactically versus raw force, like the Romanoff character might have. Like, and he was always my tank. I always imagined him sort of like the silent, gruff Russian who always could use the biggest, heaviest weapon, and he was the one to always use the proton axe, and he's the one who could tear through stuff, but the leader would always point him in the right direction at the right time to actually inflict maximum damage. So, and again, that was interesting, because, like, the game didn't allow me to sort of, like, imagine I was a Russian character. They actually allowed that as a character option in character creation, where you could choose your race. And that allowed me to find each character more. Like, they allowed to, like, be, you know, Chinese, Caucasian, Russian, all those things. And because that option was available, suddenly that allowed me to role play more.
Wasteland was the first game, or one of the first games, rather, to have a persistent world that changed so often in the game. Like, how did you find that? In terms of especially with an immersion of a game, cause like stuff like that, it can really add to, yeah, it can really add to the immersion of a game.
So I loved it because I think the more you allow the player to physically change the sandbox with their actions, that just empowers them even more. And the way Wasteland would do it was actually several ways. So for example, like there was one town where you could get access to a howitzer and then find shells for it and then start raining down shells on different parts of the town. So when you went back to those sections, they would actually reduce to rubble. You'd see people like, you know, staggering around from the explosions. And that was very surprising. But at the same time, like, oh wow, I can make these changes in the world. At other times, they would sometimes be associated with bugs. Like Wasteland had this really horrible bug where, because there was only one save slot and it automatically saved you like whenever you left an area, there was like one part of the Vegas sewers where if you make a misstep, you fall into the sewage and you get irradiated. But what was worse was the flow of the water would actually carry you off the map. So you would get dumped out in the desert, damaged and irradiated, and the game would save. And that often got many parties killed because the environment was influencing such an effect. And that was pretty crazy. But on the other hand, the Vegas sewers were really cool because they had setups there that allowed you to make permanent changes to the environment that made it more navigatable. Like you'd set up rope bridges, you'd, you know, blow up sections of walls to make more progress. And all those things were persistent. And that sort of gave you more of a feeling of empowerment in terms of, well, I'm making these changes in the environment that are actually allowing me to progress and shape it in a way that allows me to conquer it. So in terms of player like empowerment and agency, I think that was really important.
In terms of that persistent world, like so many games today like have, you know, like open world and persistent worlds are a big part of games today. Like it's baffling to see that. I read on Polygon earlier today a Ubisoft interview, and because they've just released a Division, and mainly all Ubisoft games are basically open world now. Assassin's Creed, Far Cry, etc., etc., etc. And the Division just came out yesterday, and I think it said something about how in 2008. The open world genre was something like, I don't know, I can't remember the exact figure, but I think it was something like 11, 10, somewhere within the 10th area. Now it's 30% of what the games industry makes. And it's baffling to see how even persistent worlds, say, 30 years ago, like in Wasteland, let me rephrase myself here, like, it's amazing to see how worlds have evolved from games in 30 years ago, from stuff like Wasteland to stuff like now with Fallout 4 in Boston, with Skyrim, with even with modern open worlds like with GTA 5 and even with The Division, essentially.
Yeah, I think it's been an amazing change. I mean, like when you enter an area in Far Cry 4, one thing I like is just that there's almost 360 degree of actions that you can take and different ways of approaching each of those sort of like interest points that just makes it, it pulls you along rather than pushes you along. And what I like is this, especially for some of the Ubisoft games, like for example, Assassin's Creed 2, Their stronghold mechanics are really fantastic. Like you feel like you're taking back more of the city. The amount of stuff that you can add to your stronghold is fantastic. Like it blows me away. I mean, that's a prime example of like from an RPG perspective. Those are the kind of things that you want to examine in more open world games like that and bring back to an RPG to sort of loosen them up too, because I think they set a really good example for ways to approach gameplay. And sometimes they're also really clever about, you know, the gameplay and making it fit within the context of the narrative. So for example, like this, I don't think this is a spoiler. I'm sure probably everybody knows about it, but for example, like in Far Cry 4, when you're sitting down to have dinner with with a crazy bad guy, and he gets up from the table and says he'll be right back, your first instinct is, well, shit, I gotta get out of here. But, and you know, then he goes off screen and you hear a lot of screaming and obviously someone's being treated very unpleasantly. But from a narrative standpoint, you can just still set the table.
And I did that. I did that. Like, I did that.
And then he comes back and the game's over. But the, see, narratively, that makes sense. I'm like, okay, well, he did say he'd be right back. And the way that they sort of like threw in the face of game logic there, because like obviously like the immediate reaction is get up, run, escape, blah, blah, blah. But literally he just does come back. And the game's over. I'm just like, that was well played, Ubisoft. Well done. That was fantastic.
I got my 40 points worth just getting that. as far as I was concerned, I was like, right, that's it. It's in my top 10 for the year, just for that alone. It was excellent.
I was pretty impressed with it. I enjoyed Far Cry 4. It was fun.
I'm quite surprised not many games do that kind of narrative, for lack of a better term. I'm quite surprised there's not a lot more games that do that kind of narrative points in the game, like just leaving you still at that table in Far Cry 4. I really wish a lot more games would do them.
It's kind of a challenge to argue within a game design team initially about why that's fun and versus why it's a talking point. I would argue that talking points like that are absolutely worthwhile. And that one didn't feel like a very complicated one to do. That just seemed like it's, I think from a, just talking about it is fun. So I think people sometimes just don't have the time to think about things like that. Effectively, it's kind of like an Easter egg. And while Easter eggs can be fun, the idea to actually have an Easter egg that's more prominent like that isn't something that maybe developers are accustomed to or comfortable with. But I think those things are kind of fun to do.
How did you find the atmosphere of Westland? It was very heavy for a nuclear wasteland. No pun intended.
Yeah, it's so first off, I thought it went from Looney Tunes, it was a really crazy version of the 80s. Like for example, the agricultural center in Wasteland 1 had just, you were attacked by giant animals all the time, like giant rabbits and you know moles and stuff, like just a bunch of giant cartoon critters. What it felt like, but they were really deadly. So that was kind of crazy. But then it would go to scarier areas, like you'd find like the abandoned mines, for example, and that was sort of your first encounter with Wasteland's precursor to the Deathclaw, the Shadowclaw, and then that got terrifying. And so it sort of went from sort of like, let's not take ourselves too seriously and make a bunch of crazy cults and, you know, crazy radiation situations, sort of like what fantasy authors in the 80s would imagine a apocalyptic wasteland to be like. And then the last half of the game, which as I understand it was Michael Stackpole did probably the last half of the game and sort of drew everything all together. Then the game started feeling a lot different in a good way. Like the other stuff was fun before, but now I was getting more of a sense of what the coherent threat was. What the danger was, the communities, and the situations you were confronting. Like, for example, that android's brain started getting very imaginative. And it also felt relatively grounded. Like, I could still believe these situations were happening, no matter how crazy they were, because they sort of had a unified theme of this artificial intelligence and these robots coming together, and then horrible ecological experiments taking place. But it was all tied together in a pretty nice way that I think really propelled me towards the end game.
Wasteland's combat system, like, again, like, how did you find that?
Well, going back to it's a bit rough because, obviously it's very systematic in terms of, like, it's just, you know, random encounter after random encounter. I do enjoy it. I didn't necessarily like splitting up the party in Wasteland 1, especially if you're in combat, because it just took too long. I would have liked to have made more use of the party split mechanics, but it was a little bit more cumbersome just because of the way it was set up and the technology at the time. Other than that, I did like the combat mechanics a lot for the same reasons that I liked the Bard's Tale mechanics. Like you had to risk about, you know, there was always the risk of your gun jamming, but I always felt there was a nice steady progression of cool weapons. It was really cool for once to keep track of your ammo, which was something new that wasn't usually done in previous RPGs. So like you get really excited about finding flamer fuel, for example, because suddenly, oh, okay, now I can start using the flamethrower again. Okay, that's fantastic. Or, oh, well, here's the advantage of having a proton weapon is that, like, you know, my proton axe is not going to run out of power, but that just means I have to endure a lot of gunfire before I get close enough to actually plant that proton axe in somebody's head.
As well as that, Wasteland is known for really black humor. Not saying dark humor, but dark humor all the same. How did you find that?
Oh, I thought it was pretty funny. Also, they extended that humor outside the game. Because the way Wasteland was set up is because they couldn't display huge chunks of text, they would they had this paragraph book that came with the game. So you'd go to various encounters, and they say, "Hey, go to paragraph 32." And you flip open the book, you'd read the paragraph for what was going on, and then you'd go back to the game. Now the designers correctly realized that any player, when they have a paragraph book, they're just going to read it start to finish. Regardless of whether they encounter the game or not. So what they started doing was including false entries, and then they had an entirely different plot line in the paragraph book. That you start with paragraph one. There was some Martian invasion, I believe. It was totally crazy, but they were obviously having fun doing that, and it shows in the game itself as well.
I think I may have asked this question already, but if I haven't, then I'm going to ask it again. What games recently have captured Wasteland's tone and personality that as of late, like besides the year and a half that you've just been kind of busy with, like what games, like let's say this past decade, have done the tone and style of Wasteland very well? And one caveat I will add to that, you're not allowed to mention Wasteland 2.
Okay, that's fair. For that level of whimsy, I actually can't think of something that jumps to mind. Like even the closest successor to Wasteland that wasn't Wasteland 2, which was Fallout, it had a level of humor to it. It had things like cults, and you know, it felt in some respects like Wasteland, but it never really got as wacky as I think Wasteland 1 did. Fallout 2 sort of got close to that wackiness, but in a different direction. But in terms of recent games that have had that level of whimsy, I haven't played Undertale yet. I really want to. That, I've heard, might approach it. But nothing else really jumps to mind.
So what else do you like about Wasteland that we've not talked about tonight?
Well, I've covered the inventive use of systems, the ideas you can clone your characters, which would basically be almost impossible. Almost impossible these days. The idea that suddenly, like, you could duplicate all your stats in the character model. There's a lot of complications involved with that. What else was cool about the range of companions you could get were interesting, but I don't think that's unique to Wasteland. I don't know. I think it was just the blending of all those systems, the ambience of the world, the locations you could explore, the way you could develop your character. The fact that somehow toaster repair was somehow, you know, a valuable skill. Little touches like that, I think, just sort of made it stand out because I think all those things worked really well together.
What didn't you like about Wasteland?
Well, first off, the character generation in terms of, you know, the random roles. I'm glad that archaic RPG mechanic went away and was dropped in favor of character point building, which I think is a far better system and gets people in the action a lot sooner. I didn't like the vagueness of what your goal was at the start of the game. I would have appreciated more clarity there. Also, and this is a problem we had on Fallout 2 back at Black Isle, I don't think there was a creative oversight in keeping all the themes across areas consistent. And I think that contributed to the wackiness. Like, the last half of the game felt a lot different than the first half of the game, and both of them were fun to play, but when you take a step back, they don't always feel like they're part of one cohesive world. And Fallout 2 had that problem as well, where because there were so many different voices and so many different sections of the game, and there wasn't anyone to unify those voices, each area feels different when you go to it, even though there's a lot to do. And I think that's sort of why you have like a creative lead or sort of like a project director that can go across all those areas and sort of smooth them out and sort of either take out elements that are too bizarre or like ask or request that people add certain things to sort of add consistency. So those are some of the things that I didn't like.
What would you change from a design perspective on the game?
I think I might move the starting point to more of the center of the map. I felt that some of the systems they tried to use for fast travel were sometimes very confusing. Like the way Wasteland would handle fast travel is you would usually find a vehicle that you would pop into, and then it would automatically drive you to a new place, which helped you sort of figure out what the next stage of the plot was going to be, but it felt a little clumsy at times. The other thing I would change is Wasteland was kind of unusual for RPGs, and then there weren't any healing potions. So what you had to do was you had to have a medic. And generally, everybody had to be a medic, because if you only had one medic and that guy was shot, like the game was almost over. Unless you could rush back to a merchant to get healed. So when you were out in the field, it was pretty brutal because someone would get wounded, and once their condition, which went below a certain point, which was very easy to happen, then almost immediately after combat, you would sit there with all your medical characters and keep using the medical skill on that guy until he improved. And that was sort of a gambling mechanic in the sense that you could beat a combat, but you might still die. And that was interesting. The other unfortunate mechanic of that is the only way to heal after like these comatose conditions or serious wounds went away was basically pressing the space bar and letting time pass to heal up, which basically sucked. So basically it was a mechanic that made you stay in place repeatedly until you were all back to full health, and then you hit the next combat and then you go through that again. So rather than helping with the forward momentum of the game, it actually slowed things down.
On touching upon its legacy, it'd be hard not to talk of a legacy of Wasteland without mentioning Fallout. And it's because obviously without Wasteland, there is no Fallout. Fallout and Fallout 2, at least pre-Bethesda days even, talk of those experiences, because like for me, I'm only familiar with Fallout 3 and New Vegas and 4, because like those are the games that speak to me as a kind of quote unquote, I'm using the air quotes here, you can't say it, modern gamer, so to speak. Whereas with Fallout and Fallout 2, they speak to, and this comes back to the playstyle song that we were talking about earlier, because like Fallout and Fallout 2, they were more of the Wasteland breed, so to speak.
So Fallout was a good lesson into why it's okay to do a successor to a game that isn't in the same franchise. The goal with Fallout was, because Interplay couldn't do Wasteland anymore, we're going to make a new setting that is post-apocalyptic that feels sort of like Wasteland, and Fallout was the answer to that. Originally, it was supposed to be using the Steve Jackson GURPS system, but I think like almost halfway through development, I think that didn't pan out. So then it became another happy accident where they're like, okay, well, we can't do GURPS, so now we have to make a brand new system for this Wasteland spiritual successor. And the confidence level at Interplay at the time, they didn't think Fallout was going to like do a lot of numbers. They didn't think it was going to be like, you know, very successful. So there wasn't a huge push internally from the studio to sort of like give it a lot of hype and marketing, especially like, you know, since, you know, Baldur's Gate series was around that time and that was getting a lot more numbers and a lot more attention. But then Fallout came out and a lot of the freedom aspects in terms of role playing hadn't been seen in a while. And even better, they had done some very innovative things with how dialogue worked, like how quest solutions worked, that people hadn't seen before. And that ended up being something that caused it to really stand out, aside from the fact that it was just a really great RPG. And the things that I think worked really well, which, you know, you could point to some of those same elements in Wasteland, is the plot was very, very simple. Just like Wasteland, was almost ridiculously simple. But because the characters you met were so interesting, and also they were, in this case, like the voice acting for it definitely caused those NPCs to be a step above as well. And it wasn't just their looks, but the way they talked and the voice acting crew they got for it was amazing. So that helped convey the story that way. Also, I think the project directors for Fallout had a much different approach to how RPGs should be done, where they're like, well, if we're going to provide you with a selection of skills, including speech or science, we need to make sure those things are valuable in the game. And they did. Like, one of the most amazing sequences I think I've ever had in a role-playing game, which Wasteland didn't do, was, you know, you get to the end of Fallout, and if you have the speech skill and you've explored the environment and you've talked and interacted with people like people with speech skill should do, you suddenly realize, you know, all the flaws in the bad guy's plan, and even better, you can prove it. And that sort of speech combat you have at the end where you present him with the evidence as to why his grandmaster plan is bullshit, and then he agrees with you, was the most amazing thing ever. I'm like, what just happened? I convinced the bad guy he was wrong. Like, I never felt more powerful until that moment. And that was as a speech character. I'm like, I have never seen this before. It's letting me win without combat. And I thought that was great. I was like, oh man, this game is fantastic. And they allowed options like that. There's always like a stealth option and the fighting option. And then the talking option. And then they would add variations to it, where like if you were a really stupid character, they'd add all the stupid dialogue, where like your character couldn't talk very well, and like the amount of options he would get would clearly indicate that he wasn't the brightest tool in the sharpest tool in the shed, and all of those character builds were viable. Like you could solve the game using a combination of stuff. So I felt like I was role playing. It was really great.
And of course, we can't talk Wasteland's legacy without bringing up Wasteland 2, which kind of brings a full circle for you, because you were involved with Wasteland 2. So, what was that like? Because, like I said, it just brings everything full circle for you. Like, you playing Wasteland is your favorite game, getting into the industry, it just kind of brings it full circle.
Yeah, so I'd been a big supporter of seeing the franchise come back for a long time, because I would talk about it quite a bit. And then I think because I talked about it quite a bit, Brian Fargo dropped me a line, which was, you know, I was like, wow. And he's like, well, you know, there's a chance that if you wanted to, you could become involved with this. And that was unusual, because I wasn't used to being able to do projects outside of the company I was at. And I definitely love Wasteland. So Brian worked out a contract with Obsidian, where they would pay Obsidian for me to be working on Wasteland 2, which worked out really well, because Obsidian needed the money at the time. I felt like a prostitute again, but at least I was enjoying myself having sex with Wasteland 2. So it did feel like coming full circle, because all of those areas that were in Wasteland 1, we got to revisit. I mean, a good percentage of those in Wasteland 2. So things like places like Highpool or the Agricultural Center, as well as new areas like Los Angeles, were like, oh, wow. So now we get to go home, but then we get to see more of that world. And that was really exciting. And a lot of the stuff that had sort of been like sort of signposts that I'd remembered about Wasteland, you know, like the, you know, the toasters and the, you know, the certain very specific Wasteland elements, to see all that stuff come back as well, was, I was just really happy for the opportunity, and I certainly really enjoyed myself. And if there are subsequent Wasteland games, and I'm sure there will be, I am very much looking forward to seeing where that franchise goes.
Mentions. Go for it.
FTL. To the point where when I encountered one of the FTL developers, I volunteered my time to work on the Advanced Edition. I told them, you don't have to pay me. The only thing I want to do is just work on your game because I love it so much. So I was putting in a great many hours into FTL. They initially, I think, were skeptical that I was that was a real offer. But when they dropped me a line, I confirmed that, hell yes, it was. So I spent several weekends just typing out encounters for the Advanced Edition, and that was a very gratifying experience. The subset games guys are very humble. They're nice. They're really relaxing to work with. Design discussions tend to be very friendly and very, we just care about the game. Let's just chat about that. And no one gets so attached to their ideas that they get defensive about it. We just talk about stuff, and that's fantastic. So FTL jumps out. Other titles that have hit recently. Again, I haven't had a lot of time to play stuff. And I unfortunately am playing a lot of mobile games because I'm often on a jet somewhere. But one of the games I'm kind of enjoying on the mobile space is there's this very, and I hate to say the word cute, but there's a very cute game called Dungeon Boss, where it's one of the ex-BioWare developers who worked on Knights of the Old Republic, the MMO. He actually moved over there to be a designer on it, Damien Schubert. And so I started playing it, and the game has such a beautiful blend of Minecraft-style characters that are very blocky, but then they're combined with some Warcraft element, so the color schemes are a lot different and cute. But what really sells that game is how they name some of the special abilities and how they work, and then also the animations they have for the abilities. So, for example, and I'll try and be really quick about this, they have this very classic knight character. You're like, oh, he must be really noble and heroic. And he's got this taunt ability, and it's called Bring It On. But when he does it, it's not just a taunt that he uses, it's the animations that he uses. The first two, I was like, okay, well, that's kind of classic. And if the first move he does is he draws a blade across his throat, and it's this little tiny cute character doing that, which was funny. But then he plays this one taunt animation where he just turns around and he points his butt at the enemy and waggles it, and then taps his sword against his ass, and then he turns back around and goes, Bring It On. And when I saw that, I'm like, wow, that animator must have had so much fun that day doing that taunt animation, and it totally works for me, and I never get tired of seeing it. I just thought it's so cute and clever that it's just really well done. Anyway, yeah, so I've been pumping a lot of hours into that.
One other game that I'm quite surprised you hadn't mentioned already, System Shock 2.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, yes. So, when coming on the show, Johnny's already aware, but for the audience, it was a big toss-up between do I talk about Wasteland or I talk about System Shock 2, and that was really tough because System Shock 2 is almost the same level of regard that I have for Wasteland. From its character development mechanics, from the psionic abilities, from the way they made monkeys scary. Like, how the hell do you do that? And the voice acting for the enemies, just like the cannon fodder enemies, especially the midwives in System Shock 2, is the creepiest shit. The protocol droids with their cheerful exploding tactics, Shonan alone, like Showdown's just such a good villain, and I like the exploration of the areas, even though often they were very simplistic in the goals, the presentation of it was just amazing. And the way they did time limits to create a sense of urgency without killing the player, I thought was brilliant. They had like implant timers where all we could do is inconvenience you if the time limit ran out, but it worked really well for pressure and urgency because you were always watching those timers because you really did want all your abilities to be at full power because it was a pretty dangerous environment. So yeah, I love so much about that. Oh, and last thing I have to point out, System Shock 2 did cutscenes the right way. And if you're not a developer, just so you're aware, cutscenes take a lot of time. And not only that, cutscenes are dangerous if they exist in the game world because you have to be very careful the player can't interrupt them. And System Shock 2 very neatly sidestepped that issue by including those sort of psychometric visions in the game where you'd see ghostly cutscenes play out. And that's something they brought into the subsequent series as well. But because they were all transparent, you could have these cutscenes going on and the player could run through them and try and mess them up. But because they were ghosts, it didn't matter. It would still play out around you. And that was brilliant.
If I put it to top three games ever, what would they be? Obviously, Wasteland at the top, and then System Shock 2 and second, I assume. So what would be third on that list?
Probably Ultima Underworld, the first one. Yeah, when it came out, it was one of, it may have been the only, one of the first real first-person free movement dungeon exploration fantasy games, but it wasn't just that. There was so much they added to it that made it almost beyond an RPG experience. And the things I could point to are the game in one level, you have to learn another race's language. I rarely see that. You have to learn how to speak like a lizard man. They had talking doors, and that was interesting. I'm like, oh, I wasn't expecting that. Also, at the end of the game, and it was... I was so used to the end of the game being, go find the knowledge you need to beat the boss and then go kill the boss. But in this game, when I got to that guy that was supposed to provide the exposition, he quite simply told me he didn't know. And I was like, what? Because it was very late when I was playing it. I was trying to finish it and I couldn't stop playing it. But I was sitting there standing in shock because I was having this dialogue with a spirit that's supposed to know how to beat the bad guy. And he's like, well, I don't know what to do. What do you think we should do? And I'm like, oh my God, this game is asking me how to solve it. And then I got really excited by that. Then I'm like, oh, okay, well, what do I know about the bad guy so far? So then I started doing keywords for that. And then using those keywords and then how the mechanics had worked at other levels of the dungeon, we worked out a plan together, or what felt like together, to beat the bad guy. And I thought that was amazing. I'm like, this game is encouraging me to participate in the end boss sequence in a way that I've never seen before. Like, I feel like it's much more of an interactive experience. And that was a brave design decision, which puts a lot of trust in the player. And I felt more powerful for that experience. I'm like, you know what? I feel like I'm more in charge of what's going on. Even though that's probably under the hood a very scripted sequence, it still felt like I was participating and I was the one that came up with the idea. Well, I'm always happy to do my best to answer any game developer questions that people who want to get in the industry or are in the industry have. I always take questions either, you know, email or Facebook or Twitter. Twitter is usually the easiest. You can usually find me there at Chris Avalon, imaginatively enough. So if you ever wanted to reach out or had a question about the industry but were too afraid to ask, don't be afraid to ask me, because I was once in the same place and I could never get answers to any of my questions. So now I'm on the other side. I don't want to be that person. So if I can help, please feel free to reach out. I do try and post job opportunities for people looking to get in the industry or who are already in the industry looking for a change. If you ever want to just follow my Twitter site and check for game development opportunities, I post those as well. In terms of games, I'm working on Divinity Original Sin 2 with Larian Studios. I'm having a blast with that. I think the storyline is going to be very cool, and their origin story concept is also very cool. Torment Tides of Numenera just finished up its writing pass. I think people are going to be very, very happy with that game. It feels very tormenty. There's other projects coming down the pipe that I can't talk about right now, but hopefully at some point in the future I can.
Can you excuse me for a minute? I'm just going to turn on my light because it's getting very dark. This is going to happen.
Johnny, are you recording in the darkness?
There we go. Let there be light and all that. Right, where's the mouse? Oh, no, it's here. I don't know where I've put my mouse. There we go. That's not a euphemism, by the way. Thanks for listening to My Favorite Game. Next week, Nina Freeman on Final Fantasy X-2. And here's a taste of what they expect for the rest of the season. Until next week, bye-bye.
It was my first professional game review. I was my first review for Polygon.com in the summer of 2012. And oh my god, do I hate that game. I will never replay it.
Like, I spent way more time looking at other kinds of games or outside of computer games. Like, I was super interested in baseball and why things worked the way that they did and why, I mean, for me, it was like a perfect game as a system. And I always wanted to know why things were better than, why one player was better than another player and how I could think about that.
It did really work as maybe a last great title on the Dreamcast because of that, because it was kind of like, this is what the Dreamcast can do, here's, you know, our last amazingly pretty game. Although, of course, it wasn't the last game, but I think it was definitely a good end to the console.
You can travel underwater and fly in the air, and there's this crazy campaign that you're going through, and you can create a character that's able to flirt out of prisons and do all of this other stuff. Like, you're like, wow, that's super ambitious, that's super crazy.
I tried playing all the other Final Fantasies and just didn't get as into them as I got into that one. And there's just something really... That is one of those ones where I think it was like the story and a combination of things. I loved the world building in that game, but it was also like the timing, the age that I was, and, you know, kind of everything about that time when I played it.
It's like the least economically well-built game ever, because there's all this unique shit in it that doesn't serve any purpose. But it does, because actually... That's what makes the world for great, because you can go exploring.
When I started at grad school, Tracy Fullerton invited me to join her Halo 2 clan, in which they would just go Halo hiking. So they actually wouldn't engage in the arena at all, but go hiking around the edges, because it was unbelievable. Like, that game, just the online worlds were so gorgeous, like, compared to anything else that had been released.
It's one of those things where I think it removes so many barriers to entry and just lets you focus on the best parts, which are the sort of team improv and planning and consequences.
I was just kind of blown away by it sort of visually at first, and then realized that the story was really exciting to me sort of as we played, you know, the first kind of intro to it when we rented it. And then I was like, okay, I have to go buy this game. So I bought it, and then I just played and played and played until I beat it.
My favorite game.
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 My favorite game is